Taiwan Today.
Going on to 15, Press TV will be celebrating its 14th anniversary, July the 8th, under not-so-celebratory circumstances. On June the 22nd, 2021, the US seized the station's web domain. That's a reminder of how we have to be on our toes, not to avoid a fall, but to quickly control damage. Over 30 outlets linked to the anti-Israel resistance movement were shut down, although it's not that easy to block country domains, as that'll arouse international objection to undermining country sovereignty. So the US effort will have been a wasted one. Iran just continued with its .ir domain. So feel free to search our content on PressTV.ir. Not now, because I'm here now to demonstrate PressTV's challenges as well as its pros and cons. On the matter of finding ways around U.S. hindrance, our guest offers his insight. Dr. Masoudi is faculty chief at Surrey University. An old hand in the world of media, he offers insight into the why of actions taken, say, by the U.S.
Well, the first thing is that we anticipate what they want to do. When this foresight is there, we can take immediate action in case it happens. Fortunately, there are two important facets to the cyber world. The first is that there is a huge amount of information in circulation, and control, censorship, and other actions that would stop that flow aren't feasible. But they can monitor our data, and because there is no center to the internet, there is no command, and that's what enables us to relaunch our websites thanks to our technical and IT capabilities.
Excuses for taking Press TV off air or blocking it out of cyberspace traditionally tend to be feeble. The U.S. Justice Department said 33 of the seized websites were used by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union, which was singled out by the U.S. government last October for what officials described as efforts to spread disinformation and sow discord among American voters ahead of the 2020 presidential election. Notices on the domains said the websites were seized as part of law enforcement action by the Bureau of Industry and Security, Office of Export Enforcement, which is part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. One would naturally conclude the U.S.'s motives had nothing to do with Iran having possibly broken media regulations, but were rather an extension of U.S. sanctions against this country. Economic sanctions. I asked how it is that the supposed defender of freedom of expression just gets to block Press TV's coverage at will.
Behind Western democracy, the interests of multinational corporations are hidden. The European and American media basically rely on large multinational corporations. Some of these companies, for example, also produce home appliances. Unfortunately, I've heard recently that the head of the Home Appliances Union had complained that 400 containers of the devices were being brought into the country, many of which were products made by the same multinational companies that are shutting down our national television and radio. Their interest lies in influencing Iran's booming market and selling their products here.
Press TV was far from alone this time. Some other websites seized were Al Alam newscasters, as well as Al Masira TV of Yemen. Also seized were Palestine Al Yom, a Palestinian-directed broadcaster, Karbala TV, the official television of the Imam Hussein Shrine in the holy Iraqi city of Karbala, Iraqi Afaq TV, Asia TV, and Al Naim TV satellite television channels, as well as Naba TV, which reports the latest stories about Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf countries, as well as Bahrain's Lualua TV, a channel run by opposition groups with offices in London and Beirut. Mr. Abedini is a high-up figure in Iran's media world and a media analyst worth hearing out.
Ma az inke nizam solte
We are not too surprised that the system of domination removes any voices that aren't theirs. If it accepts the voices to be heard, it would face a contradiction. That's because it's been portraying a picture of other nations that was a lie, and then its people would question them as to why they hadn't been showing them the facts. If it suppresses those voices, it would violate the principles of liberal democracy. But they've gone for the latter because they think it benefits them more.
Press TV's past experiences of interference with its flow of speech span a decade. On 20th January 2012, the channel's license to broadcast in the UK was revoked by Ofcom, the UK's media regulator. This was on the grounds that the company's editorial content and control came from Tehran. Press TV and its partners argued. London offices of CNN International, Bloomberg and Al Jazeera all ultimately answer editorially to bosses in Atlanta, New York and Doha. Also, if real editorial control of the station was from Tehran and that was a problem, it would have been a problem also when the Ofcom license was first granted. Tehran maintained the Ofcom decision was a clear instance of censorship, and Press TV continued to broadcast in the UK via its YouTube and Facebook pages. Now, logic aside, here's some juicy information that will uncover the UK's ulterior motive. Courtesy of WikiLeaks, it came to light that 2 years earlier, the British government was reportedly planning to strike a blow at Press TV. That would be in 2010. This would be in retaliation for the blocking of Western satellite channels by Tehran, as Jeffrey Alderman put it. A proud Zionist, as he calls himself, he appeared on Press TV panel discussions and bore witness. I have never been censored, nor has the company ever made the slightest attempt to get me to modify a particular view. Now, this voice of balance has been silenced, meaning Press TV.
We're all familiar with the contradictions within the liberal democracy. People in London used to have access to your channel, Press TV, and the number of viewers there were growing fast. They couldn't tolerate this growing number of viewers and had to stop it by revoking the channel's permit on the basis of falsehood over some alleged complaint of a journalist who's detained in Iran, which of course doesn't have anything to do with that. It doesn't come as a surprise to them. They try to impose limitations on any of our media that are influential around the world.
In early April 2012, the Munich-based media regulator BLM announced it was removing Press TV from the SES Astra satellite for having no license to broadcast in Europe. But Press TV produced documents showing it could broadcast under German law. And Munich's administrative court announced on June the 15th, 2012, that the ban was illegal. The ban, in other words, was based on false premises, no subjective misjudgment even.
The same goes for freedom of expression. They let bomb-making tutorials for Iranians be circulated, but don't accept the smallest move that would go against liberal democratic thoughts and immediately take the page down. They don't allow the photo of General Qasem Soleimani to be published, but there are tens of accounts belonging to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. How can they explain this contradiction?
The silencing trend went on again in 2012 with Eutelsat and Asiasat. Iran survived by striking deals with smaller companies in other countries. Then in 2012, Intelsat took Press TV off air along with several other Iranian channels for fear of US sanctions. Years later, from 2019, Press TV has found itself on and off social media platforms more than once a year even. In April 2019, Press TV reported that Google blocked its access along with Hispan TV, its Spanish language sister channel, without prior notice, citing violation of policies without explanation. No explanation came as no surprise to Press TV, of course, as it believed it had not violated any of Google's listed policies. Press TV accused Google of censorship, as Google owns YouTube. Dr. Sepanji joined us by Skype. It was worth establishing even an online connection to hear his analytical views.
Countries have a set of domestic regulations that can be used for that purpose. There are international unions that we can use to make complaint. Most importantly, the ITU, which belongs to the United Nations, but that requires a team of experts who know the language of international law, are familiar with the legal frameworks and international conventions. All's not lost. We're dealing with private companies. We've seen what happens to private companies such as Google and Microsoft in Europe. Courts issue rulings that the companies are obliged to accept them and respect public opinion, protect privacy, and deliver the message to the audience.
Come January 2020, YouTube deleted the Press TV UK channel, which hosted hundreds of videos and boasted 28,000 subscribers. That was days after the US killing of Iran's top military leader, Qasem Soleimani, which suggests the real motive behind censoring Iran is to silence its inconvenient truths. Dr. Dabiri Meh shares his views with us as a media analyst with a bird's eye view as he reviews all Iran's global media content.
I think Press TV successfully represented the demands, tendencies, and alternative thoughts in the United States concerning the U.S. government and its politicians in specific periods. The American society is a huge pluralistic entity compared to the government, but the American media, like CNN, have reduced that huge society to the administration, the president, or the White House, as if they are the voices of the pluralistic American society. But that couldn't be further from the truth. There are numerous unheard voices in the US about a variety of different topics. In my opinion, Press TV has been very successful in representing them, attracting a large audience.
Come 2021 and the sixth and seventh rounds of the Vienna talks to revive the nuclear deal, Iran's PressTV's.com domain, among others, was seized by the U.S. This is while the talks are basically to clear the air between Iran and the U.S. to get U.S. sanctions lifted off this country and the deal going. But is it a surprise for once?
This goes back to the history of American diplomacy and the techniques they use in their negotiations. When they want to clinch a deal, contrary to popular belief, they tend to maximize pressure to grant the smallest concession and gain the biggest advantage. Iran isn't the only country targeted by this strategy.
Press TV reserves its right to pursue the case legally via domestic and international channels while switching to local domains in different countries it covers. The channel released a statement promising to carry on as the voice of the voiceless, sanctions or otherwise. It called the U.S. seizure an act of terror against the world's public opinion and media robbery and dictatorship. This is while taking the ban also as a compliment, given it sees Press TV's accurate, timely, and voluminous information dissemination on Palestinian efforts against Israeli usurpers and the latest war they imposed on Palestine as cause for this blocking of the web domain. Press TV and independent media supportive of the resistance are paying for continual failures the U.S. and its allied regimes have experienced in the field, the statement continued. Also, to continue physically, there are requisites, the most important being to keep the channel's heart beating, or hearts beating rather, albeit with a hiccup in the beat. But before taking a closer look at the makeup of Press TV, let's see what other media outlets have to say. And here it is in words. Wired points to how a U.S. seizure of websites poses a danger beyond today. The U.S. takedown of Iranian media sites extends a thorny precedent. Free speech advocates raised concerns after the Justice Department seized more than 30 domains this week. It's really unclear why the U.S. government acted on these particular sites and why now, or what their standard is for intervention, says Evelyn Dureck, a research scholar at Columbia University's Knight First Amendment Institute and a lecturer at Harvard Law School. One of the core principles of free speech rights is that government restrictions on speech should be transparent and justified, and that's not happening as much as it should. The contrast between how we talk about foreign disinformation and domestic disinformation in this space is really stark, she says. Foreign disinformation gets talked about with really militarized language, while domestic disinformation gets talked about in the language of speech rights. The reason this matters is that it means we don't demand the same level of transparency, justification, or oversight of enforcement measures when it comes to foreign speech. It's part of a wider trend since Trump's maximum pressure sanctions on Iran were implemented by taking down some Iranian sites by the Department of Justice and Treasury, as well as platforms like Twitter and Instagram taking down some users, says Narges Bajoghli, an assistant professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. News Talkit explains the distrust Americans have in the media. Americans' trust in media is lowest in the free world. The public will forgive the honest mistake. Those who seem to specialize in flitting around the edges of the truth have earned a distinction. A new report shows that U.S. trust in the news media is the lowest in the free world. According to the Patriot Post, new data from Reuters' latest digital news report shows the degree to which Americans don't trust the MSM, at least in relation to people in the rest of the world. The U.S. comes in dead last, ranking 46 out of 46. The mainstream media has denied their bias for years, and the viewing public became less trusting and more suspicious when what the MSM served up didn't square up with what the public knew to be true. That limited trust has eroded even further now that the media makes virtually no attempt to disguise its own partisanship. In other words, Americans don't trust the media because the media isn't trustworthy. We've got Tasnim News quoting Hassan Nasrallah. Hezbollah chief slams U.S. seizure of resistance websites. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah said the United States' recent seizure of website domains tied to pro-resistance media exposed Washington's false claims about democracy and freedom of speech. In a televised speech on Friday, June the 25th, Saif Hassan Nasrallah said these outlets play an important role in supporting the Palestinian cause against Israeli occupation and take a stand against U.S. domination, sedition, and takfiris. That would be it for this segment, but do stay on.
Thing is, Western bans aside, National TV's World Service hasn't been receiving its funding necessary for paying satellite service providers and for other payments. But as it turns out, enough of the station believes in its mission more than the money it gets to pass round. And this is a fall that should pass, given objection and at times action across the board by different guilds and groups, such as professors and MPs, objecting to budget cuts.
Unfortunately, problems concerning logistics, finance, and support for overseas and international networks are due to a lack of understanding of media diplomacy, national information transfer, and branding on the international stage. We are suffering from this in our country. I'm not trying to say that we don't have people who can understand this, but they are a minority. Those who are tasked with decision-making, allocating budget, and even media and communications planning in the country don't have a clear understanding of these facts. They think these are liabilities, while they need to know that they are indeed investments.
And so the channel's hearts are at work. Those would be the newsroom and correspondence office or Tehran Bureau. There's the website as backup with farther reach given its greater accessibility, and the programs department, which holds it all up like a backbone with in-depth analyses of hard news topics. TV, of course, is a team effort and joint enterprise between the technical, academic, and literary for a balanced political message to be aired and shared. Let's not forget foreign correspondents complementing the Tehran Bureau, etc., etc. There's so many people doing so much. Press TV has had a clear vision and mission from the start, and with the emergence of media diplomacy as a determining factor in shaping minds, it cannot abort now.
In general, I think we have been successful in planning for such channels. in identifying the audience and delivering the message to the target audience. There are some reasons for the shortcomings, including their removal from the satellite channels list or social media platforms over issues related to the sanctions, and so on. In my opinion, if these hurdles didn't exist, our overseas networks, which have been operating for several years, would be even more successful.
Since 9/11, Western bias has divided the media into two camps, purported Press TV at its onset, the Western camp and the one supporting extremists and Al-Qaeda. Press TV came about during the US's round of retaliatory attacks on regional countries, Afghanistan, then Iraq, because Iran was automatically being encircled by US forces while its peaceful nuclear program was coming under attack. So it set out to give a second eye to Western audiences to promote an Iranian perspective of the world based on truths on the ground in West Asia and America specifically.
In my opinion, the English language media in Iran have two chapters on history. One coming before the overseas networks, and specifically the Press TV network, and one after it. Before that, their reach was very limited. They mostly targeted Tehran-based embassies and businessmen staying in hotels or those who visited Iran. That was a very limited reach. But the overseas channels started to snap Iran's image on the global stage. First kicked off by English-speaking Sahar channel and later continued by Press TV.
If the US removes Iran's voice from satellite channels and social media, how does it deal with the voices of the people of China, Russia, Venezuela, Bolivia, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and others? Even if it suppresses all those voices, what would it do to the people of the US who are saying, "I can't breathe"? How will it silence that voice unless it literally kneels down on the necks of every single person and suffocates them to silence the voices? Unless it makes the impossible move, it seems that the voices will continue to be heard.
It's not just thwarting Western media and political propaganda away from Iran by unveiling what was actually a US allied occupation of the Middle East or West Asia, but sounding the concerns of the voiceless everywhere. Press TV prides itself for having given Iraqis a voice and objecting to a US occupation and presence in their country, for example. Launched in 2007 as Iran's first 24/7 international English-language news channel, Press TV presents world news round the clock, as well as some 15 programs made here in Tehran alone and documentaries, never mind chat shows by its London company and news coming in faster and more accurately from its foreign bureaus. Five bureaus in some of the world's most important cities, London, Beirut, Kabul, Damascus, and Baghdad, help Press TV in this mission, as well as covering not just the most important stories, but also the most underreported stories.
I think these networks can have a wider international presence. They can use independent experts from around the world. There is no denying that the correspondents at the scene of the incidents are doing fine. They're using local and international reporters, but it's still not enough. I think they need to increase their potential by 30 to 40%. Of course, interactions with the world's greatest channels could also prove useful, especially in terms of the training of human resources and interacting with different networks around the world and being present at the scene of events.
Press TV personnel have given their lives in efforts to find out and or air the truth. Maya Nasir, Syed Farhad Taqaddusi, Habibullah Husseinzadeh, and Serena Shim made the sacrifice in revealing what is withheld from a global audience. And this news network continues to operate round the clock in spite of sanctions and blocks and loss of human resources. Thanks for being with us. Till next week. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
People cannot feel safe just because they had the two doses, announced WHO Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products, Maria Angela Siamo. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by William Rivers Pitt, writer. This article is published under the heading, As Delta Variant Spreads, WHO Urges Masks and Social Distancing. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The World Health Organization, WHO, dropped a large and dispiriting brick. Due to the sprinting rise of the Delta COVID-19 variant, everyone needs to continue wearing masks and keep practicing social distancing. For millions of vaccinated people who have rolled in the freedoms newly provided by the shots, this was profoundly unwelcome news. People cannot feel safe just because they had the two doses, announced WHO Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products, Mariangela Siamo. They still need to protect themselves. Vaccine alone won't stop community transmission. People need to continue to use masks consistently, be in ventilated spaces, hand hygiene and physical distance, avoid crowding. This will continue to be extremely important, even if you're vaccinated when you have a community transmission ongoing. The abundance of caution on display is due to the Delta viral variant, which was born in the cauldron of India's ongoing COVID misery and has begun making itself at home and around the world. That you see is the merciless genius of the virus. It seeks only to replicate itself within human hosts and is always evolving to thwart our immunological vaccinated defenses. Alphabetically, chronologically, the virus is getting better and better at its primary objective, infecting us. And experts suspect that it may be a while yet before the pathogen's contagious potential truly maxes out, writes Catherine J. Wu for The Atlantic, adding, as long as the virus has hosts to infect, it will keep shape-shifting in ways we can't fully predict. That biological caprice makes it harder to anticipate the next pandemic hurdles we will need to clear and assess the dangers still ahead. One of the inescapable question marks that arise when dealing with this willy foe concerns the vaccinations themselves. Do they work on the variants? Will they always work on the variants? How safe am I after having gotten the shots? Turns out it may partly depend on which shot you got. The vaccine set off a persistent immune reaction in the body that may protect against the coronavirus for years, reported the New York Times recently. The findings add to growing evidence that most people immunized with the mRNA vaccines may not need boosters, so long as the virus and its variants do not evolve much beyond their current forms, which is not guaranteed. People who recovered from COVID-19 before being vaccinated may not need boosters, even if the virus does make a significant transformation. Strange how this the recent announcement about vaccination effectiveness came on the heels of the recent WHO advisory that we should all continue to wear masks. Maybe not so strange. The inescapable truth emerging from this ongoing crisis is that very little of it is, in fact, under control. Half the U.S. population remains unvaccinated, including children under 12. And certain segment of that unvaccinated population disdains even the most unobtrusive protections as an affront to freedom because Trump. Many areas of the world beyond the U.S. borders are struggling to contend with the pandemic, allowing the virus to replicate variants that will continue to test progress, if not subsume it altogether. There are concerns that what people have experienced this spring and summer in the U.S. could possibly be a false dawn. Fake light from the other side of the tunnel that is actually another onrushing train. Thanks to the vaccines, the impact may not be as severe, but the ideological divide in this country is mutating into an immunological divide and cannot be bridged with words and promises or prices. Add to that the racist gap in vaccine access and the recipe for another gruesome winter is before Americans all. Don't toss those masks just yet.
Spotlight. Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Tahwa. In Yemen, the National Salvation Government accuses the Saudis of not offering a real solution, like failing to offer the lifting of the siege on Hodeidah port. Meanwhile, the U.S. president has so far only really pledged not to give the Saudis what he said were offensive weapons, but rather defensive ones, which many have dismissed outright as not even close to a real solution.
In the latest escalation, the Yemeni armed forces and their allies fired ballistic missiles against sensitive military targets in Ma'arib, the last major stronghold of Saudi-backed forces. Dozens were killed or wounded. But why has Yemen been embroiled in a spiral of deadly conflict? The roots of the bloodshed go way back to the year 2015. Then transitional president Abdurrabbo Mansour Hadi resigned in the face of mass protests against a faltering economy and a decision to curb fuel subsidies. He was placed under house arrest but escaped to Saudi Arabia shortly after, retracting his resignation. In March 2015, Riyadh assembled a coalition of 9 Arab countries and launched an onslaught on its impoverished southern neighbor. The campaign enjoyed direct support from the West, especially the U.S. and the U.K. The aim? Restore Hadi to power. What Riyadh expected to achieve in a few weeks has not happened after more than 6 years. Instead, death and chaos run rife. Saudi warplanes have pounded Yemen regularly since the start of the war. The conflict, perpetuated by a crippling sea, air, and land blockade, has considerably worsened the condition in Yemen, which was reeling from poverty even before the war. Tens of thousands have been killed and millions displaced. Famine is now threatening a large portion of the population. Nearly 4 out of 5 Yemenis rely on aid for survival. The United Nations calls it the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The war has left Yemen nearly destroyed. The country is in urgent need of peace, but it is not clear whether Riyadh is willing to exit from its self-created quagmire anytime soon.
Joining us in the spotlight for this edition, activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joins us from Sana'a. And also Elijah Magnier, who's a political analyst, joins us from Brussels. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Hossein Al-Bukhaiti. We're looking at the battle to have restarted for Maghreb, which is an oil-rich region. If you can, please set this up for us. Why Maghreb is important? What is the significance of this area? And in the bigger picture, in terms of the significance vis-a-vis the peace talks, if there are going to be any, how that plays into it.
First of all, I can explain why Maghreb is important. It's because that Maghreb is one of the largest and last cities that's under the control of the Saudi backed forces. And in Maghreb as well, the Saudi, when they start the war on Yemen, they start their ground attack from Maghreb, and the operation room of the Saudi coalition is in Maghreb. That's why Maghreb is in the east of Sana'a, and it was used to attack Sana'a and to attack other areas. That's why it's important for Yemeni forces here in Sana'a to liberate Maghreb. And on the top of that, when they have advanced toward Maghreb, they have put an initiative to the government in Maghreb, saying that they will stop all the attack if Maghreb and the government there will not allow the city to be a base for foreign troops and for Saudi backed forces to attack any areas in Yemen and to open the road, and as well that the oil and gas in Maghreb should be distributed towards all Yemeni equally, despite in what area they are, either in areas under the control of the so-called Hadi government or under the control of Sana'a. But of course that the Saudi-backed forces has refused that, and now we are seeing them that they are crying out loud and they about this attack, and they totally forgot that the war on Yemen was launched in 2015, and that Yemeni army here in Sana'a, they have the right to liberate every corner in Yemen. And as Sayyid Abdul Malik Al-Houthi have said many times, and Muhammad Al-Houthi and all Yemeni political and military leaders, that they will liberate all areas in Maghreb. But at this point, we see that the United Nations and U.S. and other countries who are actually profiting from this war, they are crying out loud about Maghreb, and they said about millions of people who live in Maghreb, and this is actually a big lie. Before the war, there was 300,000 who are in Maghreb, not city, Maghreb province, and maybe there is maybe 100 to 250,000 the so-called displaced people. But I want to just add, we've seen that the United Nations now trying to use this humanitarian, as they say, crisis in Maghreb as a weapon. They have actually bought those camps for those displaced people in the front line. They have put them in areas between Sana'a and as well between Maghreb city, instead of locating those camps in some other area. And about the oil, it's not the attack on Maghreb or to liberate it, it's all, as some people say, because it's rich of gas and oil. Yemen is under blockade, so even if the Houthis or Sana'a has controlled the oil field in Maghreb, they cannot export that oil. So there is no a main goal to go behind this oil field.
Well, Elijah Magnier, a very good point, I believe, Hossein Al-Bukhaiti has raised there, and that's about the fact that you have an area by the name of Maghreb that was really not well known when this war was ongoing, now entering its seventh year. And then when you look at the way that Saudi Arabia is losing this war militarily, and when it comes to Maghreb and how the Sarlo fighters are making advances there, all of a sudden it's in the news, it's in the spotlight. The Ansarullah are thwarting any peace efforts, and a huge deal is being made out of it. Why is Maghreb becoming this flashpoint when it comes to the bigger picture for Yemen?
Thank you for having me. Maghreb is important because it's the last Saudi stronghold
But it is more important, not because of that. It's more important because the Americans are negotiating today on behalf of the Saudis. They are the ones who are involved in this war directly, and they believe that the Houthis' victory is going to belong not to Yemeni people only, but also to Iran. And the Americans cannot accept or digest that Iran has won in Syria, has won in Iraq, and is going to win in Yemen, and they are going to lose their area of control and power and hegemony in the whole area of the Middle East, at the exception of the Gulf countries. This is what it's about. It is about a city that is rich of oil, that is Al-Hudaydah is not receiving more than 10 ships, despite the agreement of the UN inspectors and allowing these ships to go through. The Americans are carrying out this blockade against the Yemeni people. Now, we hear a lot of talk about the humanitarian aspect of marriage, which reminds me of the war in Syria, in Idlib, where mainstream media is talking about the humanitarian aspect of the war and why Idlib is surrounded. Well, why are we not talking about the millions of Yemeni living in Sana'a and in other side of the city that is the country that is under the control of Ansarullah, that are under the siege of the Americans and under the Saudi bombardment? That also concerns the humanitarian aspect and those concerned about the humanitarian supply to Yemen. Therefore, what we see here is the Americans are refusing to give the upper hand to Ansarullah that are winning this war. And the fall of Marib means the defeat of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia will lose its face and will no longer be representing anything in the Middle East. They've lost against Qatar, they've lost against Yemen, they've lost in Syria, they give a damn about Lebanon, so they are out politically, and that is their last stronghold.
Hossein Abaghaiti, if we were to go back to March, that is when the Saudis actually offered a peace deal. If my month is correct here, to the National Salvation Government. Many believe that that's because Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries on the ground there are losing the war militarily. Is that an exaggeration or is that actually true? Is that the reason why the Saudis actually offered the peace deal? What does that show when they were the ones that came out first offering this peace deal?
This is exactly what's happening. We remember that when Saudi-backed forces had the upper hand and the Saudi coalition, they were a few kilometers east of Sana'a in Nahm area, and they were threatened to enter the city. And we haven't seen, despite there are maybe 4 million civilians who live in Sana'a, we haven't seen any of this type of crying out loud about Marib. And to offer a peace deal, that the Saudi actually, they want to deceive the international community, even most of the UN and Azul UN Security Council are actually fully supporting this war against Yemen. But the goal of that just to show that they really wanted peace in Yemen and they want to negotiate with Sana'a. But if we look to the articles or what the Saudi has released in that peace deal, they still consider it as a civil war. They don't want to be in front for any negotiation directly with Sana'a forces, but they won't use that as they use now the humanitarian crisis to deceive the international community and to have more pressure and to get United States more involved in the war. But if the Saudi really wanted any peace with Yemen, because they are actually losing the war, that's why they use the humanitarian situation either in Marib or as well in Yemen as a weapons not lifting the blockade, not reopening any of the airport either in Sana'a or in other area, and they show that they have actually lost or military and they have lost as well politically, but they still try by using the United Nations and the US to have pressure on Sana'a to give up or to gain goals that they have actually lost by this war. And I believe that if Sana'a actually will continue to attack Saudi Arabia, not only attacking or liberating Marib, they have actually to attack Saudi Arabia, because that's the only way that they can bring down Saudi Arabia. And we have seen now how during Biden administration, the blockade has been tightened against Yemen. There are less fuel ships and humanitarian ships that are reaching Hodeidah, despite the fact there is an agreement in Stockholm to allow all the ships to enter Hodeidah because Sana'a has actually withdrawn from Hodeidah port and other area. And the main goal of the war, I just last point, is actually divide and conquer. They want to separate Yemen, north and south, and as well they want to separate the south. And we have seen United Arab Emirates, they have created a group that actually doesn't recognize Hadi legitimacy. And if United Arab Emirates and Saudi and U.S. really wanted peace in Yemen, they should actually have restored Hadi government either in Aden or in Marib. But they haven't actually done that, and they want Sana'a to recognize this government. That's why the main goal is to implement the Saudi and as well U.S. and U.K. and the Zionist state policies in our region by controlling the south, controlling the coastline, and they want Marib to stay without any liberation. So Yemenis in the north will be fighting each other, and they cannot actually liberate the south. But Sana'a now have the upper hand, and they can stop that by continuing attack against Saudi Arabia.
Well, Elijah Magnier, you know, when you look at the fact of why Ansarullah, or the National Salvation Government overall, rejected the peace deal, it was some of the points made there by our guest from Sana'a, Hossein Abu Khaiti, who basically said that the elements of this so-called offer, like the reopening of Sana'a Airport or the unlimited access to Hodeidah Port, that those were not terms that Saudi Arabia was ready to settle down with. And that's when you had the wrath come down from the UN envoy and said the National Salvation Government, they don't want peace deal, they want to continue the war. Do you think that was a mistake for the Ansarullah and the National Salvation Government to not accept the peace deal that was offered to them?
Absolutely not. The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lander King, is trying to negotiate humanitarian support in exchange of a ceasefire. And he can't do that because humanitarian support is separated from the ceasefire and the end of the war. If the Saudis and the Americans, and we better talk about the Americans rather than the Saudis, because Saudis here are very marginal. If the Americans are willing to stop the war, they lift all sanctions, they lift all siege, the maritime siege, the airport, and they allow the supply to enter to Yemen through Hodeidah and through Sana'a Airport. And then they can sit and talk about the ceasefire, and they have to stop bombing, because Saudi Arabia hadn't stopped bombing Yemen until today. Therefore, they are not serious in asking for a ceasefire and blaming Ansarullah of not accepting the deal. There is no deal so far. What they are offering is, we give you food and you stop the ceasefire, we stop firing at us. This is not a deal. There is no deal under the table that is acceptable by Ansarullah.
So Hossein Abu Khaiti, since we don't have much time left, I'm going to get right to the point of Marib. And let's imagine, hypothetically speaking, that the Ansarullah fighters make their advancements and retake that region, which, as you mentioned, is the last stronghold. They control the north and central highlands. So with the win, hypothetically speaking, of Marib, could they dictate the terms and the timing of potential peace agreements?
Sana'a can dictate any terms of to end this war, and they have actually put many initiatives saying that the war must stop, and that the blockade should be lifted, and that all foreign troops should actually leave Yemen, and they can do that by attacking Saudi Arabia. But one of the main idea for the Saudi coalition, why they have actually doesn't want Marib to fall, because as you said, if Marib will be liberated, this means that there is no more fighting between Yemeni in the north, and then Sana'a will focus actually on liberating the coast of Yemen, to liberate as well south and east of Yemen from the Saudi-backed forces. And if the war on Marib will continue as it like now, and if there is no serious step to liberate the city, this means that the Saudi actually have won the war in Yemen by dividing all country, by making Yemenis to fight each other. And I think that the United States and other country, if they really wanted peace in Yemen, Sana'a still have this deal on the table that Saudi should stop all its attack in return that Yemen will stop their attack against Saudi Arabia or against forces inside Yemen.
Okay, final question goes to you, Elijah Magnier. You had about 10 days ago or so the U.S. making an announcement that is pulling out troops, is pulling out THAAD missile systems and military arsenal and equipment out of the West Asia region, and included countries like Saudi Arabia, like Jordan. That doesn't quite go with the scenario that's unfolding still in Yemen in terms of the war continuing. I've always wondered, and I've asked this question throughout the war, and I'm going to ask this question again. Do you think that this war would end with one phone call from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I do believe so. I believe the Americans, the one who are negotiating today on behalf of Saudi Arabia, can end the war anytime. The Saudis don't have the upper hand. They don't have the authority to negotiate and to end the war in Yemen. It's an American war, and it's bigger than Yemen. It goes to bigger picture, what is happening in the whole Middle East and the rearrangement of the Middle East and who is going to control what. We see China and Russia moving in, and Russia is moving in aggressively. So the Americans are feeling the heat under their feet, and this is why they are afraid of what's going to happen next and who's going to win in Yemen. And they want to try and strike a deal. That's why they want to end this war by winning, and the Ansarullah are not allowing them to win because they've started their aggression in 2015. They have to end it today.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate your comments there. That was Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Thank you. Hossane Bokhaiti, thank you so much. Activist and political commentator there from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavit Tahwe, entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.